What we have done the last couple of lectures was putting in relativistic form, looking at the equations of motion of a particle in fixed fields, or if you have charges and currents, writing Maxwell's equations in manifestly covariant form for the equations of motion, effectively for the fields themselves. But as you know, when we go to quantum mechanics, we don't really insert F equals ma, right? We work with the Schrodinger equation or the Dirac equation, or we do Feynman's path integral formulation, and these all require either a Lagrangian or a Hamiltonian. So that's the motivation for today's lecture, which is deriving the Lagrangian first and then the Hamiltonian. First of all, for the equations of motion of a charged particle moving through fixed fields that are given by other sources other than the charge that's moving. Okay, so basically we are going to try to find a Lagrangian that will give, when we use the principle of least action or stationary action, that will give the what we now believe are the correct equations of motion. And so if you recall, we define our action typically in one reference frame, one inertial reference frame, as an integral, and I did, to remind you last time, a non-relativistic example of this, integral T1 to T2 of L dt is the quantity that we want to demand when we seek extrema of this. It will give the equations of motion when we work out the Euler-Lagrange equations. We can rewrite this, first of all, as an integral over proper time. And that is useful because what we expect is that A should be a Lorentz invariant. If we have stationary property in one inertial frame, we expect it to be stationary in all inertial reference frames. And so that means that the only thing that's not manifestly a Lorentz invariant in this integral is gamma L. So we conclude, based on this logic, just general principle, that this should also be a Lorentz invariant or a Lorentz scalar, if you like. So other considerations as we try to, you know, of course now we know the Lagrangian. One can look it up in a book, or I'm sure the chatbot could tell you what's the correct Lagrangian, but I'm kind of trying to go through Jackson's point of view here. Suppose we didn't know that, how would we try to get the correct Lagrangian? So one consideration is that we expect for a free particle, it should only depend on the speed. There's no reason to prefer one position over another position for a free particle in space. And and should not depend on the position nor on the direction of the velocity. There's no forces on the particle. Okay, and the only really plausible invariant that depends on velocity would be the contraction of the four velocity with itself. That's a manifestly invariant would be U alpha. So this, of course, is gamma associated with the velocity squared times C squared minus gamma squared U squared. But gamma U squared is 1 over 1 minus U squared over C squared. And so in fact, this is simply C squared. We usually want, let me just remind you, U alpha, its covariant components are gamma times the speed of light and the ordinary velocity. Now, normally we want a Lagrangian to have the dimensions of energy. And we can accomplish that by simply multiplying by the mass of the particle. So this all suggests that the free particle Lagrangian our guess is L is, I'll insert a minus sign for reasons you'll see in a minute, minus mc squared over gamma u. And this is, to be more explicit, minus mc squared square root 1 minus u squared over c squared. And to see if this works, we have to see whether, when we do the principle of stationary action, whether we get the right equations of motion when we look at the Euler-Lagrange equation. So let's look at the Euler-Lagrange equations for that Lagrangian. As usual, it will be partial L, partial XI. After we integrate by parts, the second term, just like we did in the non-relativistic case, we get a d by dt partial Lagrangian partial XI dot, and demand that that be zero. Here there is no dependence of the Lagrangian, explicit dependence on the positions. So basically we only have d by dt of partial L partial xi dot is zero, which reads, well, first of all, partial L partial ui, of course, we can differentiate, it's minus mc squared, we have a half times minus 2ui over c squared times 1 minus u squared over c squared to the 1 half. And this is all just gamma u m UI. And that is the space part of the relativistic momentum, if you recall. It's ith component. And so when I take the time derivative of that, the Euler-Lagrange equation says that the rate of change of the relativistic momentum, the space part of it, is zero. And so that kind of makes sense, right? Charged particle moving through free space has constant momentum. And so that's our free particle Lagrangian, minus mc squared square root minus u squared over c squared. And this does satisfy gamma L free is a Lorentz invariant, as we hypothesized would make sense. So now we want, of course, more generally, not to have just free particles, but a charged particle experiencing the joy and beauty of the fields that Maxwell gave us. So now let's consider particle moving through fields. Which are externally determined. And we can be guided by what we know in the non-relativistic limit. Which is for a slow charge particle, the force on it is mostly due to the electric field. Or the interaction energy, if you like. Mostly electrostatic. And so the interaction energy is Q times the electric potential in that limit, which would look like an integral. I could write this way of 1 over c times rho times phi integrated over the volume over all space. And so what we expect is, since our non-relativistic Lagrangian, you'll remember, is t minus v, kinetic minus T minus V, we expect that the negative of this in the zero velocity limit suggests that this should go as U goes to zero to minus Q phi. And now to generalize that to a relativistic situation, we're seeing one component of the potential four vector here. So it kind of makes sense that we'll need the entire potential four vector here. And in particular, I'm suggesting that the natural generalization to finite velocity would be gamma v for the interaction term, q over c times the contraction of u alpha with a alpha, which is manifestly a Lorentz invariant, as we know gamma v interaction must be. So this suggests that gamma L, our guess for this Lagrangian, is that it would be gamma L free minus this q over c u alpha a alpha. And this turns out to be the correct choice, in particular the Lagrangian. Now, when we go to one reference, specific reference frame, our Lagrangian then will be our kinetic part we found before. And now minus the potential part, potential energy part, q over c times c phi minus u dot a. So this is in fact the correct Lagrangian, and it is and gamma L is a Lorentz invariant under Lorentz transformations, but you can see it's not manifestly covariant. It's not in manifestly covariant form. We've written it in terms of quantities, each of which is not by itself manifestly covariant. But we should prove that this does give the right equations of motion. We haven't done that yet. So let's tackle that. The short answer is it does, but let's prove it by working out the Euler-Lagrange equations for that Lagrangian. Right, so we are going to calculate d by dt, partial L, partial ui dot, and equate it to partial L, partial xi, I'm sorry, this is xi dot, which is ui. D by dt partial L partial ui is equal to partial L partial xi. This is our Euler-Lagrange equations. So let's first do the left-hand side. Partial with respect to ui is pretty clear. That is gamma m ui plus q over c ai. And I differentiate. We already showed that first term gives gamma m ui, and the second term has a very simple partials. And then this should equal partial L partial xi, which is minus q partial phi partial xi plus q over c, sum over components from 1 to 3 of uj partial aj partial xi. So we do have a total derivative of ai, and if you remember, when you have a particle moving through a field or vector potential, the time dependence comes from two places. At a given position, the AI can depend on time. But also, as the particle moves, its position is changing in space. And so, as you are going to different positions, there is a time dependence from the particle moving to different positions. And so the total derivative has to include both contributions. There will be a term partial ai with respect to time, which is talking about the explicit time dependence at a fixed position. And then the derivative of this term gives the velocity dotted into the gradient operator acting on the ith component of A. Right. So I can write then the left-hand side of our Euler-Lagrange equations. Well, actually, I'm going to move the q over c ai derivative over to the other side now and write this as the rate of change of the relativistic momentum then is q times minus the gradient of phi ith component minus 1 over c partial ai partial time. And then there is a second term due to these derivatives, spatial derivatives of ai, which looks like q over c sum over j components. These are the space components now. U sub j partial aj partial xi minus uj partial ai partial xj. Okay, we're trying to get this into a more conventional form involving the fields so we can identify the equations of motion and confirm that they are correct. Okay, so I'll remind you, E, of course, is minus del phi in Gaussian units minus 1 over C partial A partial T. And partial AJ partial xi minus partial ai partial xj, this can be written with the Levi-Civita tensor as sum over k epsilon ijk bk, the kth component of the magnetic induction. And so this sum I wrote here can be rewritten as sum over j and k of epsilon ijk uj bk, which is the cross product of u with b, the ith component. And so finally, this derivation with that Lagrangian and its Euler-Lagrange equations gives dp dt, which again is d by dt of gamma mu, u the velocity of the particle in some particular, in the inertial frame we're working in, is q times e plus u over c cross b, and we have our Lorentz force. So that Lagrangian does work. Check. Okay. So this would be fine. If you like to do quantum mechanics the Feynman way, as constructing integrals, path integrals over the exponential of the Lagrangian. But some people prefer Schrodinger or Dirac. And those people, me included, want the Hamiltonian. Rawr. Heisenberg uses a Hamiltonian too. Oh, if Hamilton could only see what we do with his thing today, he would be quite confused. Well, to talk about Hamiltonians, we have to remember Lagrangians work with positions and velocities, but Hamiltonians work with momenta and positions. And none of this has even mentioned momentum. Well, I guess we did mention the relativistic momentum. But momentum in the Hamiltonian sense has a very specific definition. In Hamiltonian world, the momentum conjugate to a generalized variable coordinate which I'll call q I, not to be confused with the charge, is defined to be pi, which is the partial of the Lagrangian with respect to the ith component, ith generalized coordinate derivative. So if we pick our xi as our generalized coordinates, right, this means we're talking about the partial of the Lagrangian with respect to the ith component of velocity, of the ordinary velocity. And this is gamma m ui, plus q over c ai. Right. And then the way you make the Hamiltonian, if you remember from your classical mechanics books like Goldstein or whatever you guys are using nowadays, you take pi qi dot summed over I and subtract the Lagrangian, right? P dot U minus L. Now, that's not the only thing you have to do when you want to make the Hamiltonian. You have to do a second step. You have to replace or rewrite U everywhere in terms of momentum, because there should not be a velocity in your Hamiltonian. Okay, so using whatever identities you have at hand to express that express U in terms of P, you have to make this subtraction and then eliminate U from the equation. So you only have momenta and positions. So in particular, we have this P momentum is gamma M U plus Q over C A. And so we have a couple of different ways we could eliminate U using this equation. There's this, and there is also an identity I worked out in the notes, which maybe I won't reprove here, but it's in the notes, that U is also P minus Q over CA over P minus Q over CA squared plus M squared C squared to the 1/2. And plugging these in, our Hamiltonian becomes, sparing you the simplifying algebra, C times the space part of the, sorry, I should just call this the ordinary relativistic momentum P minus QA squared plus m squared c to the fourth, and plus q5x. That is our relativistic momentum. And if we want to write the Schrodinger equation for a particle with such a Hamiltonian, we would use this Hamiltonian, and if we want it in the position representation, we would do what is sometimes called first quantization. Replace the momentum conjugate to your independent coordinate positions. Replace that by minus IH bar gradient. And then that will guarantee that you have the correct commutators of momentum and positions. Okay, so that basically solves that for a particle moving through fixed E and B fields. But there's another set of equations of motion in this problem that we care about. Namely, Maxwell's equations themselves. And that takes us to section 12.7 of our favorite tome, which is working out the Lagrangian for the fields, for the equation of motion of the fields themselves. So this is a little bit mind-bending if you haven't thought through this before, finding a Lagrangian that gives fields, right? The dynamical variables in the problem are, or if you like, the dependent functions are E, it's a function of position and time, and B, it's a function of position and time, which are obviously continuously infinite set of dynamical variables. So, on the other hand, the independent variables, right? When we were doing Lagrangian dynamics or Hamiltonian, the independent variable was just the time. We were trying to find positions versus time. Now we're finding these fields as a function of all positions and all times. Okay, so the independent variables now are fourfold, all the positions in the universe and all the times. Okay. So let's set up some correspondences with particle motion to kind of guide us, since this might look a little unfamiliar. So we could say that we have some particles with generalized coordinates. And then we have either fields or potentials, phi k of x. And so we'll have an index I to indicate all the different components, and that will map on index k, I'm going to call it. There will be our independent variable, which is time independent. And here we'll have independent variables x alpha, the time position four vector components. So that's the analog of T in our previous Lagrangian dynamics. The analog of QI of T for the potential form will be phi k of x of our four vector, depends on our four vector of time and position. And the analog of qi dot of t for particle motion, the analog for fields will be the partials, let's say pick the contravariant components, the partials of the phi k of the potential kth component. Guess I ran out of room, so I just have a couple more lines to illustrate the how we generalize from Lagrangian language in particle motion to fields, right? Then for our Lagrangian for the particle case is, of course, the sum over the components, the Lagrangian that depends on the positions and velocities. And that will generalize to an integral over a Lagrangian density, we'll call it, that depends on the phi k and the derivatives of the phi k. That'll be our new Lagrangian, will be an integral over a Lagrangian per unit volume, or a Lagrangian density, we could call it. That script L thing. And lastly, we'll still have an action which for the particle motion was the integral of L dt, and that will become generalization of an integral over our Lagrangian density in both space and in time. That's our action integral. So for the EM case, for the electromagnetic field case, right, the positions, the analog of positions in the particle case are the fields or the potentials. And the role of the velocities are the derivatives, like d, things like d beta, a alpha, all those derivatives. And so we can do finally the last element is the Euler-Lagrange equations, how they will map from the particle motion case. For the particle motion, we had d by dt partial L partial qi dot is partial L partial qi. And now for the field case, this equation will look like d beta of partial of our Lagrangian density with respect to the derivatives d beta phi k will equal partial of the Lagrangian density with respect to phi k. Those show all, I think, all the connections, all the generalizations. We need to go from particle motion Lagrangian to field or potential Lagrangian. So let's think, what are the desired properties of our action? We expect A should be a Lorentz invariant. And therefore, we expect our Lagrangian density itself to be a Lorentz invariant, because d4x is itself an invariant. The total differential volume in spacetime. So how do we make our electromagnetic Lagrangian density? We expect that it's probably going to be quadratic in the velocities, in the analog to the velocities. By analogy, the particle case. So that would mean in things like d beta a alpha, we're kind of thinking that we'll see things quadratic in those. And if you remember, these appear in the field tensor we derived. Right, F alpha beta is A alpha A beta minus partial beta A alpha, the antisymmetric field tensor. Though there was a second one that we wrote with the script F, which was epsilon alpha beta gamma delta contracted with F gamma delta. Right, we wrote Maxwell's equations in terms of those. The inhomogeneous Maxwell's equations were involved this F. The homogeneous Maxwell's equations involve this funny script F. I guess I should write its indices, F alpha beta. So there are really two plausible candidates. That would obey these criteria that we are hypothesized are relevant. We could imagine the contraction of F alpha beta with itself. Might be in the Hamiltonian. Or another one we might imagine would be the contraction of F alpha beta with this script F alpha beta. But now one relevant thought about these two candidates is that F alpha beta contracted with F alpha beta, this is invariant under not only proper Lorentz transformations, but it's also invariant under the inversion operation. Whereas this contraction is actually changes sign under the inversion operation. Which means, whereas this F alpha beta contraction is a scalar under inversion, this one, this is a pseudoscalar. Now, pseudoscalars, I don't know if you've thought much about them. I know I have. They are kind of weird scalars. Whenever you see a pseudoscalar in any equation in physics, it implies there's something complicated with twisting or angular momentum, some sort of rotation is under the hood. Okay. In ordinary particle motion, a pseudoscalar would be V dot L for instance, V dot L or any vector dotted into any ordinary vector dotted into the angular momentum. That's a a pseudoscalar, since L is a pseudovector. So let's ignore the weird possibility and focus on the one that's kind of more natural, scalar, that's also symmetric under inversion operation. Okay, so basically this suggests that our free electromagnetic Hamiltonian would be proportional to that contraction of F with itself. Now, moreover, we've already talked about the interaction between particles and fields, interactions with charges and currents. We wrote a term that appeared in the particle motion Lagrangian, gamma L interaction, we said, was minus Q over C contraction of U alpha with A alpha. And so this suggests that a likely candidate for our Maxwell equation interaction part of that might be that this would be proportional to minus the contraction of our forecurrent with our potential forevector. And we could toss in a C for dimensionality. So that gives us a sort of candidate for our Lagrangian density. That we hope will give Maxwell's equations when you work out the Euler-Lagrange equations. And in fact, this structure turns out to work. You can, in fact, derive Maxwell's equations from this Lagrangian density, from the Euler-Lagrange equations associated with the following Lagrangian density, which I'll call the electromagnetism Lagrangian density. Turns out to be 1 over 16 pi contraction of the covariant F alpha beta with the contravariant F alpha beta and minus 1 over C J alpha contracted with A alpha and with the usual Einstein summation convention. Okay, that's an assertion. I guess we should verify it. So we need one partial derivative, partial Lagrangian with respect to a contravariant component beta, which is clearly minus j beta over c for the beta component. And to simplify the algebra, I'm going to introduce an abbreviation. Call this constant kappa for now. It will, because we'll have some messy algebra, which will be painful, but you've gotten used to that. No pain, no gain. know you're all saying, why can't I just use Maxwell's equations? Why do we have to do this? But one day you will want to do quantum field theory. You want to know why an atom in an excited state spontaneously emits radiation. And this you can only see with the quantized field treatment, sort of. Okay, another derivative we need. The alpha derivative, let's say, of the partial of the Lagrangian with respect to the derivative with respect to partial alpha A beta. What is that? That will be this constant I just called kappa d by d x alpha d by d of partial alpha a beta of f, let me use a different dummy summation index now, f gamma delta contracted with f gamma delta. And so let's do the algebra, kappa d by dx alpha d by d alpha a beta of d gamma a delta minus d delta a gamma. We need our metric tensor. If we write it in everything in contravariant components, we'll need the g gamma eta, we'll need a g delta mu, and then we'll have partial eta a mu minus partial mu a eta. Just some other things we'll need, for instance, this partial with respect to the partial alpha a beta of partial gamma a delta minus partial delta a gamma. This will have two Kronecker deltas. There will be a delta gamma alpha and a delta delta beta from differentiating this term. And from the second term, you'll get a product of two Kronecker deltas, delta delta alpha, delta gamma beta. These are Kronecker's delta functions here. And is there a question? It's a little more algebra, which I know is painful to watch me do on the board, so you might want to think through it in your vast spare time at home. So finally, partial Lagrangian density with respect to partial alpha a beta will be kappa times delta gamma alpha delta delta beta minus delta delta alpha delta gamma beta g gamma eta g delta mu partial eta a mu minus partial mu a eta plus partial gamma A delta. This looks messy, but don't forget all these Kronecker deltas are going to give many simplifications in our future. Minus partial delta A gamma G gamma eta G delta mu delta eta alpha delta mu beta minus delta mu alpha delta eta beta. Okay, and that can be recast as kappa times G alpha eta G beta mu minus G alpha mu G beta eta partial eta A mu minus partial mu A eta plus partial gamma A delta minus partial delta A gamma. And two more metric tensor terms, G gamma alpha G delta beta minus G delta alpha G gamma beta. Now don't forget these G's are diagonal in addition to the Kronecker delta functions. So for instance, G alpha eta, for instance, could be written as G alpha alpha Kronecker delta alpha eta with no sum on alpha. Remember, we have to say that explicitly when we deviate from the Einstein summation convention. And so similarly, G alpha eta partial with respect to eta is G alpha alpha partial alpha. And again, no sum on alpha. So all of that comes down to, I think I'll skip one line of algebra. It's in the notes, though. That clock has stopped. Good thing I have my watch. After using those formulas, we get 4 kappa G alpha alpha G beta beta F alpha beta with, again, no sum on alpha or beta. And if we want to cast that in a form that's back with the Einstein convention, we could write that as 4 kappa G alpha gamma G beta delta F gamma delta, where now we are summing over repeated indices. But this, as you know, is just 4 kappa, the covariant components, F alpha beta. So after all that scary algebra, our Euler-Lagrange equations we now have, and can see whether they are the right equations that Maxwell gave us. for kappa partial alpha contracted with F alpha beta covariant components is equal to minus J beta over the speed of light. And again, where kappa is minus 1 over 16 pi, or plugging that in, partial alpha contracted with F alpha beta, the way it's usually written, 4 pi over C J beta. And that's what we found earlier. It was equation 11.141, which we said at that time, this is Maxwell's equations, the inhomogeneous Maxwell's equations, I should say. So you might worry, what happened to the homogeneous Maxwell's equations? But in fact, the two homogeneous Maxwell's equations, right, that are not driven by sources, those two equations would be satisfied by E equals 0, B equals 0, although those aren't the solutions we care about. But the two homogeneous Maxwell equations have been basically automatically satisfied because we did this whole derivation using the potentials. The whole point of introducing the potentials was to satisfy those equations. And in fact, you can verify that by construction, that the partial alpha of this script alpha function, which is basically the homogeneous Maxwell's equations, that this is zero from the formula we gave it in terms of the potentials. One other thing I should point out is that charge conservation, or what we sometimes call the continuity equation, holds here. Because we can derive that from d beta f beta alpha is 4 pi over c j alpha by taking now d alpha of that, contracting that with the alpha derivatives d alpha d beta f beta alpha is 4 pi over c partial alpha J alpha contraction which is minus d alpha d beta f alpha beta and minus d beta d alpha f beta alpha. And because this function is equal to its negative, that means this quantity here is equal to 0, d alpha j alpha. And that is the charge continuity equation written in terms of the charge current 4 vector. Okay, I think that's a pretty good place to stop. I think you all feel like I do that we haven't done enough Green's functions in this course. And so the beauty of the next lecture will reintroduce you to Green's functions in our four-dimensional space-time. Well, we have Maxwell's equations and the corresponding wave equations that you can derive from the Maxwell's equations. That's what we need it for. And then we can have a charge moving through space, accelerated, sending out its own radiation.